Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Pope and Christ's Priestly Prayer. Pope Benedict continues his catechesis on Christian prayer at his Wednesday General Audience by reflecting on Christ's prayer at the Last Supper, which instituted the Church, and noting that Christ also implores the gift of unity for all Christians. Examining the figure of St. Paul, we explore the figure of the man known as the Apostle of the Gentiles with the help of a leading Pauline scholar. Egyptian Revolution 1 year on. Fear and frustration among many Egyptians on the first anniversary of the nation's popular uprising that ousted the regime of Hosni Mubarak. We find out why by speaking to a representative of the nation's Coptic Christian community. And Archbishop Celli, Value of Silence, the head of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, talks about the Pope's message for the World Day of Communications, whose theme this year is Silence and Words, a Path of Evangelization. Benedict reflected on Christ's priestly prayer at the Last Supper, which instituted the Church, during his continuing catechesis on Christian prayer at the Wednesday General Audience. The Pope also noted that Christ on that same occasion implored the gift of unity for all those who will believe in him. Philippa Hitchin tells us more.
Pope Benedict XVI held his weekly general audience on Wednesday in the Paul VI Hall, reflecting on the desire for unity that Christ expressed in his prayer at the Last Supper, as recounted in the 17th chapter of St. John's Gospel.
Against the backdrop of the Jewish feast of expiation Yom Kippur, Jesus, priest and victim, prays that the Father will glorify him in this, the hour of his sacrifice of reconciliation. He asks the Father to consecrate his disciples, setting them apart and sending them forth to continue his mission in the world. Christ also implores a gift of unity for all souls who will believe in him through the preaching of the apostles.
Pope Benedict said Christ's priestly prayer can be seen as instituting the Church, the community of the disciples, who through faith in him are made one and share in his saving mission.
In meditating upon the Lord's priestly prayer, let us ask the Father for the grace to grow in our baptismal consecration and to open our own prayers to the needs of our neighbors and the whole world. Let us also pray, as we have just done in the week of prayer for Christian unity, for the gift of the visible unity of all Christ's followers, so that the world may believe in the Son and in the Father who sent him.
Following the main catechesis, the Holy Father had greetings for pilgrims in many languages, including English.
I offer a warm welcome to the students of the Boss, the Graduate School of Ecumenical Studies in Switzerland, and I offer prayerful good wishes for their work. Upon all English-speaking pilgrims and visitors present to this audience, I accord and invoke God's blessings of joy and peace.
This Wednesday's general audience marked the last day of the week of prayer for Christian unity and came ahead of an ecumenical Vespers service at the Papal Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls. I'm Philippa Hitchin.
January the 25th is the day the Church celebrates the feast of the conversion of the Apostle St. Paul, and the date also traditionally marks the conclusion of the week of prayer for Christian unity. Later on Wednesday, Pope Benedict was scheduled to preside over Vespers at Rome's Basilica of St. Paul outside the wall to mark these two events. Born Saul of Tarsus, St. Paul became one of the church's foremost evangelizers after his dramatic conversion to Christianity on the road to Damascus. A special Pauline year declared by Pope Benedict was held from June 2008 to June 2009 to mark the approximate 2000th anniversary of the apostle's birth. St. Paul's letters are a primary source of information about the life of the early Christian church, and his influence on Christian thinking, arguably, has been more significant than any other New Testament author. Dominican Father Jerome Murphy O'Connor is one of the world's most renowned scholars on St. Paul and the author of several books on the apostle's life and teachings. He's based at the École Biblique in Jerusalem. Father Murphy O'Connor told me why St. Paul is such an important figure when it comes to the issue of Christian unity.
Paul analyzed very carefully the world in which he had to live because he had to change it. And what Paul saw around him were, above all, divisions, complete barriers of separation, socio-economic and religious. And his solution was to create community, to break down those barriers so that men and women, slaves and masters, Jews and Gentiles, could all live together in the unity of the body of Christ.
A leading evangelizer who travelled far and wide to spread the word of the gospel, why was St. Paul so successful in this field? Father Murphy O'Connor again.
I think Paul's success was in great part due to his rhetorical training. He refused to play all the tricks that orators use, but to the Galatians he said, "I made you see Jesus Christ being crucified." In other words, his skill was so great, he could transform hearers into spectators. And I think his success is due to his ability to bring Jesus Christ alive. He says, "I can give you only one law, and that law is Christ." Here's the unwritten law, the living law, of a person who embodies the ideal.
But what later great figures in the church were influenced by St. Paul's example and his teaching? Let's hear more from Father Murphy O'Connor.
The tragedy of Paul is that we have his letters and they were very influential. But once his personality disappeared, then the idealism of his community faded. Like the Pauline communities are extremely idealistic. Whereas Matthew's community, for example, is a management community. There's a little bit for everyone and no cohesive vision. And Paul was simply, I think, a little too strong. Remember, Paul is criticized in one of the letters of St. Peter.
So, given these criticisms, what kind of a personality did St. Paul have? Was he a rather difficult person to get along with?
I think Paul was uncompromising. He also was extremely thin-skinned and tended to identify what he would consider insults to himself as insults to the gospel. He really identified so completely with his mission that he would have been extremely difficult to live with.
What we know about St. Paul comes from the Acts of the Apostles and his letters in the New Testament, yet there are inconsistencies and even contradictions between what he says in one and in the other. And, of course, there is the fact that his authorship of several of these epistles is in doubt. Do you agree with that?
I don't fully agree with the consensus. Like, the vast majority of scholars would say that 2 Thessalonians and Colossians and Ephesians were not written by Paul. Well, I think the first two were. I don't think Ephesians was written by Paul. In its present shape, it contains an older and lost letter, the letter to the Laodiceans. And there are serious disagreements between the Acts of the Apostles and the Pauline letters. For example, in the Acts of the Apostles, Paul is forced to leave Damascus because he is threatened by Jews, whereas for Paul himself, he has to leave Damascus because he is threatened by the Nabataeans, which is historically correct. So when studying Paul or building up an image of the life of Paul, one must give absolute priority to the letters and treat Acts of the Apostles positively but critically.
Talking of criticism, St. Paul has been accused by some of being a misogynist because of what he wrote about the role of women in certain of his letters. Is that a fair criticism in your view?
No, I think it's completely wrong to think of Paul as a misogynist. That I would think he was perhaps the greatest promoter of women's ministry in the first century.
And when it comes to his theology, what do you believe are the most striking elements there? Could you elaborate for us?
The most striking element of Paul's theology is his concept of the church as the body of Christ. Now we, because of the divisiveness of the world in which we live, we tend to think of that as talking about cooperation, coordination. For Paul, it was much more profound. It was a matter of shared existence, that the arm and the leg belong to the same thing, and that is how they exist. So for Paul, we belong to one another. As he said, without love, I do not exist. And it is that relationship of love that constitutes the very existence of the body. And he calls that is the body of Christ, by which he means that the church is the physical presence of Christ in the world. If you want to know Christ, you act within the community. You don't go off on your own and make a retreat. And furthermore, for Paul, that church, the community, the body of Christ, he calls it Christ. He uses the word Christ both of the historical Jesus and of the community. And it is only when the community is truly Christ-like that it can use the first person singular. This is my body. Paul has a very varied but very consistent and radical theology.
When you say radical, what are you thinking of there in particular?
For Paul, there can be no Eucharist if the members of the community celebrating the Eucharist do not actually love one another. This is spelled out unambiguously in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. It's radical in the sense that this is a challenge to our churches, where people, the same people, go to the same Mass every day of the week and don't even bother to learn each other's names. For Paul, there could be no Eucharist in that type of community.
But we've talked quite a lot about Paul and his teaching, his theology. But when it comes to his life, of course, he was first and foremost a missionary and he did a lot of travelling. He courted a lot of danger. What do you think are some of the most significant incidents in this very action-packed life that he led?
Well, he was in and out of jail on a regular basis. He was shipwrecked and he was extremely lucky in that he survived, because no ship would divert to pick up a drowning man. It would be extremely difficult, and they would be long past him by the time they could turn around. So he must have drifted on a current that brought him to one of the many islands in the Aegean, and then he was very lucky that he hit an easy beach, not the bottom of a cliff, so that he must have been terrified every time he travelled by boat. But if it was necessary to bring the gospel, then that's what he did.
He certainly didn't flinch, did he?
Was extremely courageous. And when you think that each of his journey would be about 20,000 miles, that he must have been a very tough, fit man.
It's been pointed out that Paul's letters are full of expositions of what Christians should believe and how they should live, and not so much about the life and teachings of Jesus. Why do you believe this was so?
I think that Paul had a very detailed knowledge of the historical Jesus. Remember, he spent 2 weeks with Peter in Jerusalem shortly after his conversion, and they certainly didn't waste time talking about the weather or the illnesses of mother-in-law. And they would have talked about Jesus, and Paul refers more than 20 times to words of Jesus, and he also had a very precise knowledge of the behavior of Jesus. There were two aspects of the personality of Jesus that struck him particularly. And one was his steadfastness, his fidelity. As Paul says, our lives are yes and no. His life was an enduring yes. Now that sort of person, single-minded, can be rather cold. But the other aspect that Paul finds very significant is that Jesus was emotional. His tenderness, his compassion, his love for people. These are factors that he mentions several times. Now, Paul did all that. He spoke about Jesus when he was with these people in their conversion visit. That's when he would have spoken about the historical Jesus. The letters all deal with particular problems, and so that he simply refers to Jesus, his teaching, his personality, as something that they already know well.
Paul did, of course, in his time have many enemies and detractors, didn't he? Was it, as we were saying earlier, perhaps because of his somewhat abrasive character?
Well, Paul had enemies in the Jewish wing of the church. You see, there were those, led by James, for example, who believed that Gentiles should become Jews, that is, accept circumcision, in order to become Christians. Paul objected violently to that. But he nonetheless accepted Jews as members of his community. And he eventually turned completely against the law. Remember, when he arrives in Jerusalem for what he feared might be his last visit, James tells him, "You tell everyone not to obey the law of Moses or to follow the customs." So that for many Jewish Christians, Paul would have been the ultimate apostate.
Finally, what do you think, if you had to single out one thing among so many, is St. Paul's most important lasting legacy today?
Paul's most last important legacy to me is his idealism. Even though he knew he never measured up to the ideal that he professed, he never watered down that ideal to make himself feel comfortable. He knew he wasn't perfect, Philippians chapter 3. But all today in our modern theology, we create a theology that makes us feel comfortable. Paul would repudiate that completely.
I was speaking there to Father Jerome Murphy O'Connor, a New Testament professor and author of several books on St. Paul. Tahrir Square in central Cairo was the backdrop for the start of Egypt's revolution exactly 1 year ago, that toppled Hosni Mubarak's 30-year rule. The military rulers who replace Mubarak have pledged to step aside by mid-year and hand over power to elected civilians. Last November, in the nation's first free parliamentary elections for decades, voters elected an assembly dominated by Islamists. But on the first anniversary of the revolution's start, what has changed since the euphoria of those huge anti-government protests in Tahrir Square last January? More importantly, has Egypt's revolution stalled or failed to materialise, as many Egyptian activists claim? And what about the plight of its minority Coptic Christian population, which has been the target of several attacks by Islamic extremists since the Mubarak regime was toppled? Maurice Meunier is an Egyptian Coptic Christian who is a leading member of an opposition group calling for democratic change. He told me that on this first anniversary of the revolution, there is widespread frustration among his countrymen over the slow pace of change, and that Coptic Christians in particular are extremely worried about their future, following a spate of attacks against them.
Most people are fearful. People are fearing what's going to happen. Now, for the first time, Islamists have close to 70% of the majority in the parliament. The military council, or the military regime that led Egypt into this disaster, seems to be in cahoots with the Islamists and trying to avoid completing the revolution. So Christians are extremely worried about their future, not sure what would happen, not sure about the many talks in the media from Islamic parties of full enforcing of the Sharia law, many talks of Christians being infidels, many talks of and therefore should not be congratulated on their feast and should not be doing this and that. And people are fearing that maybe in 2-3 years we're going to be stopped from even celebrating Christmases and others if right now, without really physically taking control of power, Islamists are making up stories as such. One wonder what would happen in the future.
Do many Christians there fear another situation like that of Iraq following the fall of Saddam Hussein, where Christians have been effectively driven out of the capital, Baghdad, by a campaign of bombings and persecutions led by Islamic extremists?
Well, if the military council that rules Egypt right now continues to stand idle and watch as homes are being burned and people, businesses are looted. Itself, the council, the military, took part in the killing of the 26 Christians you mentioned because they're demonstrating for the freedom to worship and to build churches. Absolutely, it's a possibility. But if this to happen, that would only mean that Egypt is disintegrated into a civil war, practically.
And
so we're all hoping that this would not happen or this day would not come, because if we get to that day, then it's probably a disastrous day for everybody in the region.
Right, looking at the Egyptian population as a whole, are many Egyptians, regardless of their religious affiliation, very frustrated with the slow pace of change?
I think most are frustrated with the process of change. Most of them are frustrated with the pathway that we were forced to take since the beginning of the revolution, where we were driven into an election that the country was not ready for. New form of political parties have not been given the opportunity, such as our party, to campaign effectively, to reach out to people in rural areas and villages. And the military council pushed us into this election, knowing full well that only the Islamic forces are organized and well mobilized, since they've been working in politics for 80 years under the Mubarak regime and other regimes. So right now, the revolution has not been materialized. People went out and protested for the freedom, the representations, and the, as we said, bread and respect, freedom, that has not been materialized. And in fact, most people that participated in the revolution feel that they have not been represented in parliament. Youth that participated in the revolution ran for offices and could not win because they were not funded as much as the Islamists were funded or mobilized. So there's a huge frustration on the street currently with the military council and the things that the military has pushed us into, and the slow pace of change, and still people have not been tried that were supposed to be on trial. People that looted the country are still roaming free, and many of them are still outside of Egypt with money stolen from Egypt. So on the whole thing is feels like it's yesterday that when we went out on the streets and demanded all these things, and feels like no one is listening or attempting to help the revolution materialize.
Now, of course, the ruling military council has promised to hand over power to an elected civilian president by the end of June. But is there concern by many Egyptians that they may not want to relinquish power?
Well, in my view, I don't think they really get to relinquish power at all. What they will do is they, as they have been, they will bring a civilian and struck some deals with Islamists and elect that civilian while they're still going to play a pivotal role in the background and pretty much going to be moving the president whichever directions they want. And that's what we all fear. I mean, we want a free president elected fairly by the people, not a president that comes in from behind closed doors agreement between the ruling council and Islamists. As such, it would not be relinquishing power at all. It would be just masking the abuse of power, which has been going on since the revolution.
Now, of course, poverty is very widespread in Egypt. How has everyday life changed for ordinary Egyptians since the revolution and the toppling of the Mubarak regime?
It has, for the most part, changed to the worst. For some people, people that receive pensions and whatnot, when we were able to force the government to increase the pension pay or to for the poor specifically, or to start instituting some healthcare reforms and whatnot in the small areas where the government responded, that had been very effective and the poor kind of felt a little bit better. But for the most part, right now people suffer from lack of gas to heat their homes. They can't find the gas tanks. In fact, there have been many incidents where people killed each other over the gas tanks and waiting for line to take the gas tanks. So people cannot find gas in their cars in the past 3 weeks. Gas to drive, gas stations have been almost non-existent. So people have been worrying so much about this. And this is the middle class. Imagine the lower class and what have they been experiencing. It's really horrible because businesses have gone down. The economy has slumped. Egypt is running out of a cash reserve. Things are not looking good at this moment.
So how do you see the future playing out for Egypt and its people?
Currently, really, the future, in my view, is very much uncertain, maybe on the bleak side. We're still going to go into a huge fight for the new drafting of the Egyptian constitution. I know Islamic party would like to have this as a full Islamic constitution, depending on their majority or trying to use their majority in previous election, which, by the way, most media outlets reported as a fair election. It was not fair and it was not free for the most part, and for a good side of it, our estimate is about 9 million votes were rigged. But the international community, for some reason, wanted to show this as an election that went smoothly with no hitch, which completely violates what we know on the street. So we're looking at the next year or so, a very rocking political climate. There's a lot of disagreements and a lot of fights between the political factions, and we hope that this all can be sorted out peacefully. We're looking at an economic negative outlook, so this would further deteriorate the country, and not really very hopeful signs that we're looking at.
I was speaking to Maurice Murnier, an Egyptian Coptic Christian who is a leading member of an opposition group calling for democratic change. Benedict stressed the value of silence in his message for the Church's World Day of Social Communications. The theme of this year's message is Silence and Words, a Path of Evangelization, and it was presented by Archbishop Claudio Celli, President of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, at a press conference on Tuesday.
Humanly speaking, the Holy Father is touching a delicate aspect of the life of men and women today. We are giving relevance, the human relevance, to our words if these words are coming from a silent heart. It means that the silence is not a void moment of our life, but is a rich moment of our life that is giving relevance to our words. And here again, the Holy Father, in his own way, I would say a challenging way, is inviting humanity today to rediscover the real human perspective of communication. If you remember, we were analyzing in the last messages authenticity, for example. How can my word be authentic, humanly authentic, if it's not emerging from a silent heart? And so we have to rediscover the real positive meaning of silence, that is not inactivity. It is not just a moment, I would say, without doing anything. No, it's a rich moment. And humanity in silence is rediscovering herself. And afterwards, in word, is expressing herself in fullness. And so really, I think that in a very good and deep way, the Holy Father is inviting us, all of us, to rediscover such an important moment of the life of humanity. I think that here you touch the essence of humanity. Humanity has to rediscover what is the real meaning of silence in her life, because really it's giving authenticity to our way of communication.
That was Archbishop Claudio Celli, President of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.